This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Aram Sarafian about recent efforts to pass a U.S. resolution acknowledging the Armenian genocide.
And the pragmatist hypocrites who are trying to suppress it.
We have a most extraordinary guest, Henri Alleg, age 85, speaking to us from Paris on the way the French tortured him 50 years ago in Algeria.
Alleg, a French journalist, supported the Algerian fight against colonialism. As a result, he's picked up and he's waterboarded, electroshock, and other unspeakable acts. We'll see how that relates to what our country, what the United States, is doing today.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. I want to give people an update on two very, very critical issues. One, that I want people to act as quickly and as dramatically as they can, and that's on Attorney General or supposed nominee Attorney General Michael Mukasey, who is right now, as we speak, being considered for Gonzalez's old job. This is really serious. There's something people ought to do here. The two issues I want people to focus on are first, waterboarding and torture, and secondly, presidential power. People may recall that Mukasey refused to answer questions as to whether or not waterboarding was a form of torture. For all of the listeners who know our show, waterboarding, of course, is essentially drowning someone, strapping them to a board, sticking a rag in their mouth, and pouring water in them. It's been used since the 15th century, since the Inquisition. I believe that Joan of Arc was threatened with it. Certainly the French used it against the Algerians. And the U.S., the Bush administration, has almost practically acknowledged using it against detainees in so-called CIA secret sites. They have used it. There's no issue about it. It's torture, it's illegal, and it's a crime under U.S. law. And then you have the spectacle, the incredible spectacle, of Mukasey saying he doesn't know what the technique is. Until he finds out more about it, he won't say whether it's legal or illegal. Now, of course, what's really going on here is if he says it's illegal, then he has a problem. The people Mukasey will be working for in this administration all become criminals. The people who approved waterboarding, Vice President Cheney, who says, oh, there's nothing wrong with a little dunk in the water, and all of the others, essentially become criminals. So he's working for a bunch of criminals, and he's going to have to start indicting them. So he has a problem. Even if he were to think it's torture, which I don't know if he really does, he can't say it's torture, but I actually don't think he probably will conclude it is, because even if he's in as Attorney General, if he concludes it is, then his employers are essentially criminals. As people also recall, Mukasey was essentially led into that hearing on a white horse by Senator Schumer from New York, who just lauded him. And in fact, it was Schumer who apparently suggested Mukasey to the Bush administration as someone who could be confirmed, even though there's a Democratic majority in the Senate Judiciary Committee and in the Senate, they would still find him respectable enough to confirm him. It was going along swimmingly for Schumer and for Mukasey until the water board question came up and until the second issue came up, the issue of presidential power, and particularly around wiretapping. When Mukasey was asked whether the warrantless wiretapping might be or was unconstitutional, the warrantless wiretapping that the Bush administration had carried out, despite a congressional law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that clearly made warrantless wiretapping illegal and a crime. Mukasey essentially refused to answer it, but he actually answered something that is even worse. He said there may be, even when Congress has passed a law in the area, extra powers to the president, particularly in time of war, to override and ignore, violate, etc., congressional legislation. In other words, the president can be your dictator. So you have two issues on Mukasey. You have waterboarding and presidential power. The senators at this point, particularly the Democrats, really couldn't hide anymore. They tried to hide and say, he's fine, Mukasey. They were forced to send Mukasey a letter saying, please, we beg you, essentially, get us off the hook. Say waterboarding is illegal. And please, get us off the hook on presidential power. We want to help you. We want to confirm you. Sadly for those senators, Mukasey still refuses to say waterboarding is illegal. What he said was essentially that waterboarding is repugnant, but he did not know if it is legal. An amazing, remarkable statement. It's repugnant to him, but he doesn't know if it's legal. It's classic, classic torture. It's been that for hundreds of years. And this is the man that Senator Schumer and others are considering having as your attorney general. So here's what's happened since then. Schumer, relatively quiet, apparently hasn't made a decision on this. Some others have, like Durbin has said, I'm going to vote against him. One of the Democrats who initially was very upset by this has said, well, this is enough for me. That's Lindsey Graham from North Carolina. But here's what you can do. I think this nomination can be defeated. I don't know how each of you feel, but I do know that however you feel, you can make some telephone calls. I'm going to give you the general number for you in New York as well as other states that you can call the U.S. Capitol switchboard and ask to be connected to Senator Schumer's office or the other members of the Judiciary Committee. Other members of the Judiciary Committee that are relevant here, of course, are a number of Democrats, Edward Kennedy, Joe Biden, who's already said he's against it, Herb Kohl, Wisconsin, Dianne Feinstein, California, Russ Feingold, others. You can go look them up on our website at lawanddisorder.org. You can also go onto the net. But the key thing is to call this number, 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. If you're from New York, ask to be connected with Senator Schumer's office and tell them how you feel about waterboarding. Tell them how you feel about a president who thinks that he can run a dictatorship and see what Senator Schumer's reaction is. Do that with each of the people in your home states that are on this Judiciary Committee. I actually think this can make a difference. They haven't heard from their constituents. Everybody knows waterboarding is no good. So again, if you feel that way and want to say something, call 202-224-3121. While we're on the subject of torture, the Center for Constitutional Rights, a French international human rights group called the International Federation of Human Rights, a number of other organizations recently filed a case in France against Donald Rumsfeld for torture. We did that in France because Donald Rumsfeld was actually in France at the time of filing that case. Now, for lawyers, we know what that means, and I want to tell you what it means. When an alleged torturer is in a country, that country, under the Convention Against Torture, that country, under international law, is obligated to go after that person and investigate them and arrest them for torture. And if they're not going to do that, they have to arrest them and send them to a place where that person can be tried. So we thought we had a good shot in France. Rumsfeld was going to be there. We heard secretly. He did not know about this lawsuit. The day before, we went to the French prosecutor with the criminal complaint against Rumsfeld. And the next day, Rumsfeld appeared at this conference that he was going to speak at, or at this private breakfast meeting he was going to speak at. Because we had notified people, he was met by press and, of course, people yelling torturer and murderer in front of him at the door, which was a nice opening for Rumsfeld. He goes in, he gives his talk, and then, of course, he's afraid to come out. And lo and behold, apparently this room had a back door or a back door into an alley into the American Embassy. And that's the last we hear of Rumsfeld. Meanwhile, the French prosecutor is diddling around and sitting on his or her hands. and has not served Rumsfeld with the complaint or the arrest warrant or even a warrant to get his testimony, and instead is trying to make noises. Well, maybe he's not here anymore. Maybe he has immunity. And so now it appears, as of our last note from the French prosecutor, that, well, now he says he doesn't think Rumsfeld is any longer and he didn't have time to act. If you want to hear a BS reason, we went the day before. He knew he was there. He refused to do it. You know, it's basically still a good story because what we're doing is we're making the world smaller for Donald Rumsfeld. He had to leave France. He had to leave Germany before. He's going to have to leave the rest of Europe. He's going to be confined to his amazing house, his summer house, which is not the worst place, I guess, to be confined, but he won't be able to go to Europe anymore. His summer house has the wonderful name of Mount Misery. Mount Misery is next to Cheney's house, and it actually is part of, as I recall, an old slave plantation. And for our listeners who may be familiar with this, it was covered a bit in the media. Mount Misery was actually a plantation where Frederick Douglass, the former slave and great abolitionist leader, was sent when he was still a slave, when he was going to be beaten by the next-door slave owner. That's where Donald Rumsfeld currently lives. So that's an update on Rumsfeld. But really, when we think about Rumsfeld, we have to think about the fact that he will have nowhere to hide. And ultimately, I think that Rumsfeld will be brought to justice for the torture that he was responsible for, from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib to Afghanistan.
Recently, the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives took a significant step toward ending U.S. complicity in Turkey's denial of the Armenian genocide. Despite an intense campaign of threats and intimidation by the Turkish government and its lobbyists in Washington, D.C., the committee adopted H.R. 106, the Armenian Genocide Resolution. Introduced on January 30th, the resolution calls on the president to ensure that the foreign policy of the United States reflects appropriate understanding and sensitivity concerning issues related to human rights, ethnic cleansing, and genocide documented in the United States record relating to the Armenian Genocide. One day after the House Foreign Affairs Committee approved the resolution, 26-21, Turkey withdrew its ambassador for consultations, and Turkish legislators on October 17 authorized the use of military force against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq, a step that may further destabilize Iraq and disrupt oil supplies. Since 1982, successive U.S. administrations, fearful of offending Turkey, have effectively supported the Turkish government's revisionism by opposing passage of congressional Armenian genocide resolutions and objecting to the use of the word genocide to describe the systematic destruction of the Armenian people. Joining us today is Aram Sarafian with the National Armenian Committee of America. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Aram, did you have a family that were victimized by the Turks during the period around the First World War when the Armenians suffered the genocide?
I think almost all Armenian Americans did at that time. All my grandparents lived in Armenia, which at the time was part of the Ottoman Empire. I lost family members on all four sides, all four grandparents.
What was the reason that the Turks gave for slaughtering the Armenians?
Well, at the time they were doing it, they didn't give any reason at all, obviously, but now during this stage of denial that's ongoing, the reason that they've given has shifted over time. Initially, it was the Armenians had revolted, and now it's become people on all sides have died. But the reality is there was a very minor Armenian involvement in revolts along the border, but the genocide occurred to the entire Armenian population in the Ottoman Empire, not just along the border, but everywhere inland. And probably the only community that did not suffer a major impact at the time was only the community in Constantinople, now Istanbul.
Let's bring us now to the present. The history of trying to pass a resolution recognizing the genocide in this country, I understand that the House voted unanimously, was it in 1982 or 96, to pass such a resolution?
The House passed a resolution similar to this resolution, actually, condemning the Armenian genocide, recognizing, condemning it, and authorizing the president to issue an annual proclamation commemorating the Armenian genocide. It was passed in 1975 by the entire House, and it was passed in 1984. So this is not a new issue, and this is not the first time that it's been raised in the House of Representatives.
Back then, there was also an issue of denying U.S. aid to Turkey.
In 1996, there was an amendment. It was called the Radanovich Amendment, after Congressman Radanovich from California, that also passed in the House of Representatives. It said that it would cut $3 million in economic support funds to Turkey until it recognized the genocide. And the reason $3 million was chosen at the time was that was the amount in 1996 that Turkey was spending on lobbyists to deny the Armenian genocide in the United States on an annual basis. So a symbolic gesture that did pass the House of Representatives was that $3 million cut in aid to Turkey. What happened on the Senate side was they didn't use the same language. They didn't say genocide. And in the conference committee meeting between the House and the Senate, they ended up cutting the $3 million in aid to Turkey, but not using the term genocide, though it did originally pass, stating the reason was because of the genocide in the House.
Now, can you give our listeners a little bit of history on that term genocide and who first raised this?
The term genocide is a modern term. It was coined by Raphael Lemkin, the scholar, after World War II. And when he came up with the word genocide, his example for genocide that he gave was the genocide of the Armenians. He coined the term because he wanted a way to describe what had happened to the Jews during the Holocaust, but in his description and explanation of the meaning of the term, he used the Armenian genocide as the example of genocide, which I find interesting nowadays because a lot of these articles, these negative articles that have come out in the newspaper, kind of question whether it is or isn't a genocide, but the person who invented the term invented it to describe the Armenian genocide and the Jewish Holocaust, unequivocally the Armenian genocide as well.
Adolf Hitler, in fact, was quoted on August 22, 1939, as saying, "Who, after all, speaks today of the annihilation of the Armenians?"
Well, I think that's a great irony because those Republicans and Democrats in the American Congress who now want to withdraw any kind of resolution condemning the genocide are really aligning themselves with Hitler's loss of memory, aren't they?
They certainly are. They're certainly doing a disservice to what Raphael Lemkin had meant when he raised the term genocide and when he pushed for the genocide convention, the United Nations Genocide Convention.
One of the questions that we've been discussing among ourselves here has been the argument that people are saying that this is not the time to pass this because of Turkey's very strong reaction and that we have the Iraq invasion to consider versus those who say this is really a moral imperative, that it doesn't matter when we raise it, we have to pass this. What is your view on that?
It's really a disingenuous argument to say that now is not the right time because this issue of recognizing the genocide is a relevant modern issue because of the ongoing denial. And we can see that in the papers. We can see that through all the Turkish threats that are going on today. If this really were an old issue, then we wouldn't have to raise it nowadays and Turkey wouldn't react like it. But specifically in terms of Iraq and this not being the right time, this was raised in 2000 before the United States ever invaded Iraq during the Second Gulf War, before 9/11 ever happened. President Clinton had asked Congress as well, along the same lines, to not recognize the genocide because it might endanger relations with Turkey. The bottom line is, for the people who are making that argument, there will never be a good time to raise this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, if you leave it up to them, they will always find an excuse. It's never the wrong time to recognize the truth, and it's never the wrong time to recognize something as horrendous as a genocide occurring.
In your opinion, why can't the Republic of Turkey accept the fact that genocide is a part of their past, accept it and move on? Wouldn't that be better for our relations with Turkey?
I think not only would it be better for our relations with Turkey, it would be better for the Turks themselves. But I think the way their state was founded, it was founded, you know, essentially on a set of lies. They've been told there's a myth of the creation of the Republic of Turkey that the Turkish school children are taught. And anything that teaches contrary to that is viewed as heretical. And in fact, there are laws in Turkey. There's Section 301 of their penal code that actually allows for people to be prosecuted and sent to jail for insulting Turkishness, is what it actually says in the penal code. And it's applied to anybody questioning the events around the Armenian genocide. So Turks themselves, even if they wanted to raise this issue in Turkey, face prosecution and jail time as well as threats. So it's not surprising when somebody's been taught something, even if it's untrue, that they feel that they don't understand actually the truth, and that's really the problem. I think in order to move beyond this, Turkey needs to embrace the past and embrace the truth and overcome it like Germany did after World War II.
I also read that when France proposed a law in 2006 criminalizing the denial of the genocide, didn't Turkey respond by cutting off military relations and some commerce?
It did suspend some military relations, but this has been a tactic that the Turkish government has used with many countries, and France is not the first one. Anytime a country is looking at recognizing the Armenian genocide, the Turkish government is very heavy-handed in their foreign policy, as you can see in the press with all the threats against the safety of American troops or supply lines to Iraq. Turkey threatens any country when this comes up. And in fact, France passed a resolution in their assembly, their House and their Senate, in 2000, and it was signed by the president recognizing the Armenian genocide. Turkey threatened a lot over that, but since 2000, military sales, trade between Turkey and France has escalated tremendously. The difference is not the recognition of the genocide that France engaged in 2000, but in 2006, France was in the process of passing a law to criminalize denial of the Armenian genocide. That would mean that if somebody in France denied the genocide, they would go to jail. Now, a law like that is passed in Switzerland, and it was in the process of passing in France, and Turkey came in and threatened relations, and it's temporarily suspended some military ties with France, but it's unlikely to sustain those in the long run, because the bottom line is Turkey needs France more than France needs Turkey, just like Turkey needs the United States more than the United States needs Turkey.
Tell us a bit about how the Armenian National Committee of America is organizing in the face of such intimidation tactics and facing the enormous funds that Turkey has been pouring into lobbying.
Well, first of all, it always helps to have truth on your side, and I think that's the most important thing. A lot of people today are cynical about the legislative process in the United States, about the influence of special interests and big money, and certainly the Armenians have to contend with that when, defense lobbies and oil lobbies are involved in, pushing against recognition of the Armenian genocide. But I think the truth speaks volumes, and Armenian Americans, like any other American citizens, are actively involved in contacting their congressmen and in doing outreach to their representatives saying, hey, we would like this recognized. And to the credit of just average Americans who are not of Armenian descent, there are many non-Armenian Americans who've been calling congressional offices and urging their representatives and senators to vote in favor of a resolution. And I think that's very important to note, that it's not just an issue of importance to Armenian Americans, but it's an issue that's important to all Americans.
How many Armenian Americans are there now, and how many Armenians are living inside of the country that was carved out of the Soviet Union, and then outside of that?
Estimates vary. I don't think anyone's done a really accurate census, but the estimates now are, during the break of the Soviet Union, what was left of Armenia had about 3.5 million people. There are claims that that population may actually be 1 million less, up to 1 million less than that, maybe even as low as 2.5 million, because of Armenians who work outside the country and send remittances home because of the tough economic conditions there at the time.
And what about here?
And here in the United States, estimates are between 1 and 1.5 million, probably closer to 1.5 million Armenian Americans in the United States. And a lot of that community is concentrated in along the West Coast, California, the Northeast, and in the Midwest.
I would add one of the most productive and successful groups in America.
Following the House vote, President Bush has vowed to pressure others to vote against this bill. What do you say to those who argue that the passage is symbolic?
The passage really is symbolic, but it's still important whether or not it's symbolic. There are some arguments that are made, and there are false arguments. One is that we shouldn't be passing symbolic resolutions. Congress does this all the time. In fact, Congress has passed resolutions on the Holocaust, on the Cambodian genocide, on comfort women and that the Japanese took in World War II. Congress does resolutions like this on a constant basis. So this is nothing new. But what this resolution does, And it isn't targeted against Turkey. What this resolution does is call on the president to acknowledge what's in the U.S. records about the Armenian genocide. This isn't disputed. This is what America's own ambassadors and...
Henry Morgenthau.
Right, Henry Morgenthau and the State Department documented it during the genocide. It's asking him to reflect consciousness of that in U.S. foreign policy.
Aram, what can our listeners do if they want to help on this issue? Is there a website they can go to?
You can always go to the Armenian National Committee of America website. That's www.anca.org. But I think the most important thing that listeners can do is call your congressman and urge them to vote in favor of House Res 106, that's the Armenian Genocide Resolution. That would urge them to vote in favor of recognizing the Armenian Genocide. Now is the right time to do that. And also, write to your newspapers and let them know that you're upset that a country like Turkey is blackmailing the United States. It's essentially told the United States that unless we do what Turkey wants us to do, not just with the Armenian Genocide, with the Kurds in northern Iraq, that it's going to hold U.S. supply lines hostage. That's not the mark of a good ally. I'll just remind your listeners, I'm sure they're well aware that in 2003, when the United States invaded Iraq, Turkey refused to let U.S. troops come through northern Iraq. That was the 4th Infantry Division and other units. And Secretary Rumsfeld at the time blamed that decision on the fact that the insurgency was as strong as it is today. So, I mean, we can thank a lot of these problems in Iraq for the Turkish refusal to assist the United States. And I find it disturbing that Turkey today, even after that poor decision in 2003, is again threatening the U.S. military and the U.S. policy.
We definitely agree with you there, and I'm sure our listeners will too. It's truly been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder, and we hope to have you on very soon when this finally passes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Aram. Really appreciated it.
And as many of you know, there's been a big controversy going on as to whether or not the U.S. should essentially call the Armenian genocide what it is, a genocide, or be really whipped around by Turkey, who refuses to recognize the genocide. And one of the reasons we're giving this program or bringing this program to you is not just because it's a really crucial and important issue about how the U.S. plays politics with terms like genocide, and Turkey does as well, but because one of our own co-hosts, who you've listened to for a couple of years here, Heidi Boghossian, is half Armenian. Her paternal side is Armenian. Her grandmother was raised in Turkey, in Armenia, and has her own story that will give you a sense of how compelling, how incredibly compelling this case for genocide is. And when you hear this story, you will never again say there's any justification to not call what happened in Turkey genocide.
I'd always known that my grandmother was a mail order bride and had seen her family essentially massacred by the Turks, but I recently called my aunt to find out a few more details and was shocked to learn that when my grandmother was 14, she saw her entire family being tortured and then their hands were all cut off by the Turks. She was taken to a wealthy Turkish family's home at the age of 14. She was the only one, I believe, who survived, where she was used essentially as a slave to service the men of the house and their friends at night. She did a lot of manual labor, like cleaning rugs, and my aunt told me that she had to clean a rug, which a huge rug that was, when wet, was so heavy it was very hard for her to drag it back into the house. And the female head of the household threw, I think, hot liquid in her eyes, and she went blind in one eye, which I never knew before because she always was crocheting quilts and things for me when she was older. But she heard through the kindness of someone who worked in the house that there was an orphanage that was run by the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, or the Tajnaks, the revolutionaries. And at really risk of being killed if the owners of the house found out, she snuck out one night, made her way there. They arranged for her to stay at the orphanage. It was very difficult conditions, and they moved her to Greece, which was apparently even worse. But then it was arranged that she would be a mail order bride to the United States for the price of $200. While she was there, she apparently had to sew lace with the other young girls there, and she was blind in one eye, and they had to share one needle among all of them that they rotated. Armenians are known for making lace. But they sent her to Mexico en route to the United States, and because one of her eyes was clouded where she was blinded, they were afraid she was infectious, and they wouldn't let her into the United States. So they moved her to Cuba, which apparently had a more humanitarian view about such things. And the Cubans monitored her for 6 months, saw that nothing was changing in her health, and she got into the United States. Even though the $200 got lost somewhere along the way, she somehow made it at the age of 14 to Connecticut, where she married my grandfather and raised two children. And one was my father, and the other was my aunt, who's in California. But we've never really talked about this. It's kind of a shameful thing for certain Armenians to talk about it, and yet I think it's so crucial that oral history, while those who experienced it or passed it on to their relatives remember, we have to get these personal stories out to sort of humanize what I think the atrocities that many of us are aware of and how they happened and how they affected generations after that.
This is an incredibly moving story, Heidi. I mean, I'm just hearing it, I mean, it just brings tears to my eyes, but really it demonstrates how important it is to call what happened in Turkey genocide, because even people like you who are political, Armenian, really never confronted it directly in a way. I mean, am I wrong?
You're not wrong. I think what's happened is that there are Armenians all around the world, obviously more so than even exist right now in the homeland. Many of them are fighting to recognize this, but I think many are just wanting to get on with their lives and to assimilate into culture. I, however, think that the attention that's been brought to this issue recently has been so inspiring for Armenians all over the world, because finally other people are hearing about the Armenians. You know, when I was growing up, I was embarrassed to be Armenian. People would say, "What's an Armenian? Who are you?" And then there was that line, you know, that mothers would say to their children at the dinner table, "Remember the starving Armenians." That came out a lot of the U.S. aid that was given to Armenia during the genocide and afterwards. But
what years was the genocide?
Mostly around 1915 to 1925. And I mean, there were different incidents before, but I think that's the main time.
Heidi, I'm interested in, what did your grandmother actually tell you? The story you're getting now is, of course, from your aunt.
Well, my grandmother died about 10 years ago, and we never talked about it, much to my sadness. I had always wanted to interview her and try to create a record, but I knew that whenever the genocide was mentioned, she would burst into tears, and it was a very emotional thing. Really, my father never talked about it, and I also felt it was just, you know, something he'd grown up with, and I think tried to put behind him and my grandmother also. But
now, what about all her relatives, the people who had their hands cut off, her brothers, cousins, uncles?
I don't know. I assume they died.
That everybody was killed.
I assume. I do know one other sad thing is that apparently she had a little piece of bread with her when this happened, and she was separated from them right after their heads were cut off. So
from her parents?
From her parents and her aunts and uncles and siblings, and she apparently carried a little piece of bread with her for days and weeks, hoping that she would run into her mother and she would be able to give it to her.
Thank you.
We have an extraordinary, very special guest on Law and Disorder today, the author of the book, The Question, Henri Alleg, 85 years old, a French revolutionary. We've got him on the line from Paris to here in our studios in New York City. Henri Alleg was a supporter of the Algerians in their attempt to break free from French colonialism in the 50s. He was editor of a newspaper. As such, he was picked up by the French army, tortured for over a month. His book was written in his prison cell, smuggled out, became a sensation in Europe, helped bring down the French government that was oppressing the Algerians. The book has been reissued just last month. It's come out on Bison Books, the University of Nebraska Press. Ellen Ray is responsible for doing this. It's in English. The introduction is by Jean-Paul Sartre. We're proud to have Henri Alleg as our guest on Law and Disorder.
Ellen Ray, who was one of the people you worked with on your book, book is called The Question. When she talked to me about the book, I actually, to my ignorance, didn't really know of it. And of course, it hadn't been published in a number of years. And then I got a copy of the book, and the book is called The Question. And it has an introduction by Ellen Ray, then has the original preface by Jean-Paul Sartre, which I thought was really good. And then it has your description of what happened to you when you were taken into custody in Algeria during the war.
Yes.
And tell me about the name. The name of the book is called The Question.
Yes.
And why is that?
First of all, the word The Question in French has a different meaning than in other languages. It means, of course, the question, a simple question, but in the same time, it means torture. At the time of the royalty in France, in the time of the way justice was given and ordered, at that time you said, we will give him the question. That means we will torture him and try to ask him the answer to what interest is for us in his arrest. In different languages, Spanish, in Italian, in German, they called the book the torture, because it didn't mean anything in German or Italian or Spanish. That's why it was called The Question, because in the same time, you see there's a, can you call that a pun? In the book, there is only one question asked by the people who torture. They want to break the strength of resisting of the man they have in hand, and they think that if he answers the first question, he must give answers to the other questions. But if he resists the first question, so it's useless to ask him other questions. So that is why the word, the question, in the title of the French book means torture, and also it refers to what is inside the book and what I answer to the torturers.
Okay, let me ask you, I want to give our listeners some background. You were in Algeria. Can you just give us the time period and how you got arrested and what you were doing in Algeria?
Well, I landed, if I can say, in Algeria in 1939. I was 18 at the time, and it was not scheduled for me to stay in Algeria, but the war broke out. I stayed in Algeria, but very soon, after the defeat of France, the Vichy government imposed to Algeria new fascist rules, and I stayed in Algeria and quickly joined the resistance movement against the oppression of the Algerian people by French colonialism. So that was my first stand. Then I became the editor of the only anti-colonialist newspaper in Algeria. The name of the paper was Alger Républicain, nothing in common with the American party called Republicans, of course.
We're speaking with Henri Alleg. Henri Alleg was a French-Algerian journalist, the author of a book on his torture that took place in Algeria in the 50s. The book is called The Question. Henrik, after you were picked up, can you give our listeners some description of the way in which you were tortured?
Well, you know, nothing very new. I think what happened just in our time with prisoners in Iraq, also in Guantanamo and other prisons, they took the model from the French. As you know, what happened in some countries of Latin America, their teachers, if you can call them that way, were ex-French officers who were brought to the country to teach police and army how to manage with people who fought against dictatorship in these countries. So I was, in fact, I was put under, I knew already, because in my work of Algérie Républicaine as a journalist, many, many Algerian patriots would come after having been arrested, that was before the war, and tell us about the tortures they had suffered, that is, well, drowning.
One of the most moving parts of the book was when you describe what you said as drowning, what they now call, at least under U.S. regime of torture, waterboarding.
Yes.
And I'm going to read a couple of sentences from what you said about it, and then I think you, as Michael Smith mentioned, the Center for Constitutional Rights, we filed a case in Germany against Rumsfeld and others for waterboarding and other issues. And if you go to our website, which is ccr-ny.org, and you go to the German complaint that we filed, and I don't know if you know this, we opened the complaint with a description from your book of three paragraphs of the waterboarding that happened to you or the drowning. And it's quite remarkable because in this country, of course, they're claiming that waterboarding does not constitute torture. Maybe you can give a response to that and what it felt like for you a little bit, if you want to do that.
It's bringing someone to the brink of death. And it's not only a great sufferance as if you were drowning, but also a sort of terrible agony, terrible feeling of dying. You're dying. You know you're dying. Tell you that if you move your fingers, it will seize. And if you don't, you're going to die. So it's a strong torture, and perhaps even more terrible, because you have to fight against the anxiety of not being able to bear two or three times that feeling of death.
Now, Henri, I remember when I read the book, you said the first time you didn't realize it was going to happen and you didn't, something with your fingers, so that your fingers moved involuntarily.
Yes.
And then the next time you took some action so that didn't happen. Can you just describe that?
Yes. Well, I preferred death than a new trial of that feeling of going again and again near the brink of dying. A terrible thing to hear that some responsible people can say that such an experience is not torture.
Well, this is what the leaders of the United States of America are in fact saying.
What you wrote in the book is amazing about this. After your fingers moved the first time, what you said was, in spite of myself, the fingers of both my hands shook uncontrollably.
Yes.
That's it. He's going to talk, said a voice. And then the next time they did this to you, which was right afterwards, they had you strapped to a board and put your head under a faucet with a towel over it. And this time you said, this time I clenched my fists, forcing the nails into my palm.
Yes.
I decided I was not going to move my fingers again.
Yes.
It was better to die of asphyxiation right away.
Yes.
I feared to undergo again that terrible moment when I had felt myself losing consciousness. So that's the experience of it.
I wrote that book in my cell. It was in the prison of Algiers. It was rather a difficult thing to do because we were search every day. The cell was searched. I had to have friends who helped me to hide the pages I wrote. And after that, It was also very difficult to take them, to have them out of the prison. So out of the prison, it was sent by people who, attorneys, lawyers, etc., who came to Algiers, and it was printed in Paris, but very quickly it was forbidden.
It was printed while you were still in prison, is that right?
Yes, of course. Yes. I was still in prison at that time.
And it was forbidden in France?
It was forbidden in France, so it was printed illegally by different people, some organizations, and many trade unions printed it illegally. It was printed also in Switzerland, I mean, in countries where French printers, and taken also illegally through frontier to France. So it had a very important, enormous impact at that time, because what the French government said, that people who were talking of torture, people who testified against the French army, were enemies of the French government. What they said was only slanders against the army and against France, which was a country, as everyone knows, that could not torture people and could not do such things. So, and that stand kept on until 2 or 3 years ago. Yes, year 2000, until 2000, it was the official stand of the French government was there has never been any tortures in Algeria, and the people who try to slander the action of the French army in Algeria are enemies of France. In the same time, enormous when you think of it, the French authorities refused to call what had been the conflict in Algeria, to call it a war. They spoke of pacification, of a fight for civilization, and such sentences, but nothing of the reality of that terrible war.
If you have any message for the people in the United States, considering you're looking back over probably some 7 decades of political struggle as a revolutionary, as a supporter of the colonial revolution, and as a journalist, what would you tell the people of the United States now, considering the position the American government is in?
I would say that the American people should be very careful not to be led in some terrible and unforgettable way by these politicians that speak of liberty, speak of the respect of a man, of the rights of man, and do exactly the contrary of what they expose, they say. We have had that experience in France, and finally, although there were hundreds of thousands of Algerians killed in that war, in spite of the death also of 30,000 young Frenchmen in that war, finally, the people of Algeria got their independence. So that will of the Algerian people was stronger than any kind of torture and of the terrible sufferances they put to the Algerian people. That's the truth, that it is really impossible to win a war, even a long war. It's impossible, finally, to win a war against millions and millions of people who are convinced that their country must be free and who are really convinced that they will go to the end of their efforts to win the independence of their country.
Emery, thank you. That was really moving. And I want to go back just briefly to your story again. You're picked up by the French army in 1957.
Yes.
And how quickly did they begin to torture you and interrogate you?
Well, it was exactly a few hours after they arrested me.
And they began by doing what to you to begin?
Well, first of all, it was electricity.
They used electricity?
Electricity, and then fire, you know, and papers like torches. I was hanged by the legs, the feet, and my head was, of course, near the ground. And so they burnt me with these torches, again electricity, and then water, and then also what they called in French, serum de la vérité, the truth serum. That's used in some places to put the man they torture under some sort of fever and try to get out what he doesn't want to say willingly.
So they use torches, they use electricity, and when you referred to water, that you're referring to the drowning and the waterboarding, right?
Yes.
And for how long a period did you undergo this?
Well, it lasted for about 3 days and three nights.
And after that, what happened?
And after that, they, of course, made lies, telling me that they torture my wife. They had arrested my wife. And in that building where tortures were used, many women were also arrested. And during the night, I could hear the women arrested scream under torture. And I thought that I recognized the voice of my of my wife. And then they prepared to shoot me, as they did with other prisoners. So my friend, I was arrested at his house. He had been arrested a day before. He was tortured and probably killed under torture. And then they asked me to accompany them, and I supposed that they had prepared to shoot me. But something happened. I don't know exactly what. Maybe the fact that my friend had been killed, that stopped them at that time. So after a month in that house of torture, they led me to concentration camp. And in that concentration camp, the paratroopers could take anyone they wanted without any notice to the judge or to any regular legal organism. But during that month, I managed to make my fate known outside. It was known in France, so they could not go further. The fact that my friends in France and in different papers, I was known as the editor of a newspaper, they asked the government and the judges to send me to prison if they had something against me, and not to keep me in that concentration camp, which was a very dangerous situation, because they could take you any time and bring you back to that house of torture.
You know, Emery, that's very similar, really, to what we have today at Guantanamo or Bagram or in Iraq, where they have people without any charges, and they're holding them indefinitely, and they're able to torture them or interrogate them coercively, whatever term, and there's no charges. And all our clients and all we're asking is you either release people or you charge them.
Well, you know that all these ways of acting, they called it the French school.
School.
It's a French school. They learned it from the war in Algeria and before also the war of Vietnam, but especially as the war in Algeria was so near France, and the soldiers that were sent to Algeria were young people who were doing their conscription time in Algeria, which was not the same in Vietnam, where the Vietnamese-French war was the professional soldiers. And in Algeria, during the 7 years of war, nearly 3 million young Frenchmen went to Algeria. So it's rather different.
Henri Alleg, thank you very much. You're the author of the just re-released book, The Question. The book was a sensation, a bring-down-the-government book when it came out in the late 50s in France underground. It's been reissued because of its total relevance to the situation in the United States. We want to thank Ellen Ray for her new introduction to the book and for getting it out in English. The Question by Henri Alleg, A-L-L-E-G. It's available from Bison Books, the University of Nebraska. You can get it on the internet. We urge all of our listeners to read Henri Alleg's book, The Question. Henri, you have our greatest admiration and respect. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Henri, and for writing that book, which has been very significant
to
all of us.
Thank you to you, and I apologize to all the listeners for my rusty English.
So not rusty, did really well, so thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.